You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello, Launch Street. Your host, Tamara here. I got some words for you. Business, professional, buttoned up, polished, and my favorite, let's level this up. I don't even know what that means, but does it sound familiar? But where does humanity fit into this? What do we do with our personal, emotional, the human side when we go to work? I think there's this myth that somehow when we walk through the office doors, we're supposed to leave our personal side behind, but we're human beings, and I don't know about you, but I find that really hard to do. And not only that, but our customers, our clients, and us, ourselves, we make decisions emotionally. It's crazy talk that it's like you either have to be business or you have to be human and personal. And today's guest is going to help us blend the business and the human side. Jeff Chan is a thoughtful, engaging presenter and really a compassionate coach who closes the gaps between seemingly disparate worlds with his deep understanding of both the human condition and a strategic business focus. So he draws on his experience in pastoral psychology and education, combined with his years as an international corporate executive and consultant. So Jeff is encouraging us to accept that we prosper when we are both people and profit focused, both personally and in our businesses. In a unique way, Jeff works with organizations to connect them to their people and purpose as much as their bottom line, actually. So cool. But before we start, you should know that this podcast was brought to you by Brility Digital, who tackles incredibly tough business challenges from a strategic growth perspective in order to implement the most effective digital resources in order to meet your objectives. All right, let's go blend business and personal. Here we go.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
All right. So, you know, I like to start with a little personal. What's the one thing people would be absolutely surprised to learn about you?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, thinking about this, I think it's that I really am a bit of a junkie for the 1930s. I don't know what that means, but I have a 1935 antique car. And my first house was built in the same year, actually. So I really enjoy the 1930s for some reason. A little odd, I guess.
What is it about the 30s that you love? If you were to define that era, what is it?
Yeah, I don't know, because it's also the time of the Great Depression. I think it's the cars. I think it's the way that people dressed and just sort of, I don't know, a bit of the class that people had, the music. There's just something intriguing about that decade for me.
My gosh, that's kind of fascinating. I could take a whole podcast on that, but that is not our point today, so I will move on.
That's good. I'm not an expert on the 30s either. So.
But that's interesting. I mean, I have a thing for the 70s, and I was born in 72, so I'm a little too young for the 70s. You know, I was too young at the time. But every time I hear the music and the clothing, I'm just like, ah, the 70s.
Yeah, that's neat. Yeah.
So I kind of get it.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So I want to dig in because you have this interesting perspective and experience of merging kind of business focus and strategy with human condition. And will you I just want to open up, just talk a little bit about how those two come together for you. And then I want to dig into some concepts in particular.
Yeah. So I think it really comes out of the earlier part of my career where I actually spent a lot of time working in psychology, not-for-profits. In fact, worked in a Protestant church as well, sort of a very socially active Protestant church. But I've always been entrepreneurial as well and sort of transitioned at some point to starting my own organizational consulting practice and then working corporately as well. And just really saw this gap between in the nonprofit world, you know, almost at times a self-righteous attitude about the work that that can be that they're doing, and staying away from really good business practices at times, and then vice versa in the business world. And really, it's, you know, you need both, right? You need both. So that's where my interest really came, is how do we combine the best of being human with the best practices in business, and that these two things aren't separate. In fact, they in the best scenarios, they need to be integrated well.
And do you think that if you look at just today's world, that we're moving in that direction? It seems like, you know, all the emphasis on culture and other things are really about the emphasis on the human side of business too.
Yeah, I think we're moving that way, but I honestly, I think there's still very few companies that are they're doing it with deep integrity. You know, I sort of equate it to the days when people lamented that small independent bookstores were going out of business for the big box stores, and this, you know, at the same time, I think the people that were complaining about it were still buying their books at the big bookstores. So you know, there's right. this idea that
Fair
it's
enough.
A good thing, and
yeah.
It's important, but. When we know it's important is when we really are sort of evaluating people's performance based on it, and corporations' performance based on it. So I think people recognize it's important, but it's still sort of one of those, yeah, it's kind of important, but it's not the real business.
Well, and I think just to use your example, and if I think about other things in life, kind of like, you know, maybe composting or going a little more green or not, you know, using recycled products, it requires a trade-off. And people have to be willing to do the trade-off for the benefit too. I mean, everything in life requires a trade-off of some kind.
That's right. In business, yeah. It's often money or profit, or and we set up or people. And so, you know, at the end of the day, how do we make those decisions? And is it always, well, at the end of the day, profitability wins? And we've set up this sort of separation that it's an either or instead of an and conversation, really.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I think, too, the other thing I'd add to your list is time. You have to be willing to invest the time to work those things through and actually make them a priority, which is a whole different ballgame. I want to dig into something that you talk about, and it's going to kind of take us down a path. But I was so fascinated by it because I think pressure, stress, conflict, all of those things in the workplace, as we talk about merging those two things, are things that we are afraid of, we tend to run away from. But you talk about how pressure affects workplace identity in particular. So I wanted to get your perspective on that, because I think it's one of those topics that we're all – it's like an elephant in the room of we don't know what to do with it or how to deal with it.
Yeah. So I think first of all is recognize we're under pressure most of the time at work. And what happens is, though, I don't think we really are aware of the effects of that. So under pressure, just from a basic sort of biology point of view, you know, we go into this very kind of primitive survival mode, right? Where when we're in that place, it's a place of how do I kind of survive my day? How do I survive my manager? Or how do I get through a meeting? And when we have different ways that we respond to pressure, I mean, there's the basic fight or flight, right? So some people under pressure become very dictatorial and demanding or autocratic. There's other people that leave, right? They quit or they run away, or some people might just kind of hide and they don't want to be seen. But that pressure has an effect on us, and it really immobilizes us because we move into this place of just surviving. And what happens is out of that place is we start to form behaviors. And those behaviors now start to form our identity. So it's how people get known as sort of hotheads or defensive or difficult to work with on Wednesday afternoons or whatever the
right,
whatever
not the communicative, not
yeah,
engaged.
That gets,
yeah.
Exactly. Whatever that gets created. And then we take it a step further and we say, well, that's just the nature of the workplace. That's just the nature of industry, or we call it personality difference or office politics. When really I think that's just an excuse or justification for us not really understanding what's happening and then dealing with it in a positive and productive way.
So I've got two questions for you. I'll start with just, I want to talk a little bit about pressure, because I think we can all relate to, there's a lot of extreme pressures, a deadline, something didn't go right, a product launch, a challenge that's, you know, hurting our business. I mean, they're the things that are kind of obvious. But what do you think, or is it more a symptom of those underlying like pressures that are just, they're almost subtle, you know, like every day you face them, but it becomes the norm. You don't even realize you're under that pressure. It's not the big things. It's those Hopefully I'm making sense. I'm just kind of thinking and talking at the same time.
Yeah. I think that, first of all, we're not conscious of it. That's the first problem is first we have to understand that, look, when I'm under pressure, biologically, I go into a survival mode. And there's ways we can recognize it. One of the easy ways to recognize it is through our language, right? If we can just get through the next
right.
quarter.
I just got to finish month. This list. I just have to get through the day.
So yeah, exactly. So survival, listen to the language that people share in the workplace and in business. So first, recognize you're under it. Two, do some reflection on how do I respond to pressure? Do I tend to get very animated and short-tempered or dictatorial, or do I just want to flee? I got to get out of there. And we have to overcome that instinct. The other thing we do under pressure is we also create a story about it, right? So we have a justification or a story we tell ourselves of why this is okay or why it exists. And now that becomes our identity in the workplace, like I said earlier. So first is just that self-awareness of it. And then there's ways that we can kind of pivot out of that as well.
So if I'm a leader and I've got a team and I'm listening to you and I'm going, wow, we just operate on daily pressure all the time. And yep. So what do I do about that? How do I get myself and my team out of that place? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but I have to imagine that also hinders your ability to do good work. If you're in fight or flight all the time.
So let's just back up and say pressure's normal. Pressure's okay. Where the challenge is that we don't understand that how we click into survival mode is now I start to see others as either the enemy, right? So she's out to get me sort of idea, or I see them as sort of useful and kind of feeding what I need. And that's how we start to see people in our workplace. And this comes just sort of from an evolutionary point of view of where we had to actually survive. But in the workplace, no one's trying to kill us, right? It's not do or die. And these are some of the myths that get created. So pressure is normal. What's not normal is for us to experience it and take it to this kind of extreme and allow that to govern how we do our meetings, our leadership, or our business. So we need to – pressure's okay, but it's just to recognize, okay, we're under pressure. What's the next move that we need to make so that this doesn't overcome us and we kind of move through it?
So you're saying you're not going to get rid of the pressure.
Correct.
The question is how you deal with it.
And understand what it's doing to you, your team, and your identity. Absolutely.
Yeah. So this kind of leads into my next question around, you talk a little bit about people feel like they're surviving at work. And you were just saying it with the language. Like, I just got to get through this quarter. I'm in very survival mode all the time. There are a lot of people. A lot of my clients are too. What effect do you think this has on your ability to innovate, to engage, to kind of do the things that we really need to do in business today?
Right. Well, look, I think it shuts it all down. So first of all, if I'm in survival mode, I'm not in a mode of prosperity or possibility. So it's sort of you get what you get. If I'm just going to survive the quarter, I'll probably just survive the quarter, right? It's not going to be a magnificent quarter. But it shuts it down because we're very inward, right? So we're very reactive and defensive. And so in terms of innovation, I think innovation happens in the opposite space. It happens when we are open. It happens when we become curious. It happens when we actually create an intention about what it is that we want to see in the world or in the marketplace or in our business. And when we can get clear about what it is we want to create or what that result is we want, all kinds of possibilities emerge. So I think in that survival mode, we're pretty focused on just are you out to get me? Am I out to get you? Or do you even matter at all almost? Versus what are the possibilities? And the antidote to that for me is curiosity. So if I can just be curious about a problem, I can be curious about what somebody said, I can, it creates the space for new things to happen.
Do you have key questions or ways to do that? Because, it's been my experience that we're, particularly in the work world, we're so busy trying to get to the solution. We jump from the challenge, the question, whatever it is we're doing, the opportunity, to here's how we solve it because we got to move. What do you do to back up and stay in inquiry a little bit longer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think first of all, part of it is us getting in that place of just curiosity. And I know I've said that, but when you're in a place of just curious, no matter what somebody says, instead of judging it or knocking it down or saying why it won't work, I'm exploring it. So you're really in that place of explore. Oh, tell me more about that. Why would you think that? Where did that come from? How do you imagine that might work? So first is this attitude almost of curiosity. And the other is to start to remove the variables that people want to naturally throw up to shut it down. So you'll come up with an idea, for example, and somebody say, well, we wouldn't have the money to do that. Right. Or we don't have the manpower to do that or whatever it might be. So just keep removing those variables. What if money and manpower wasn't an issue? Then what would we do? So it helps some individuals get into or more into that space or place of what's possible, because we're naturally wired to the negative, actually. And in survival mode, we're definitely kind of wired to see why things won't work. So we have to work really hard to see why things can or might work. Right.
You know, yeah, it's interesting what you're saying. So one of the things that I have a colleague who's big in the neuroscience field, and he was telling me that our brains can't innovate and analyze at the same time. And I think we think of that in terms of brainstorming, like let's come up with all the possibilities and then we analyze them, and that's fine. That's the way to do it, although it often doesn't happen that way. But really what you're saying, what I think is so powerful for all of us to pay attention to, is it's not just in the moments where you're trying to, brainstorm new solutions and you don't want to have judgment in the room, but it's also when you're dealing with something in the workplace that, because we're trying to solve it, what that really means is we're trying to analyze it versus just be curious about it. And that we have to really hold that desire at bay and really think about, all right, I'm not going to analyze the challenge yet. I'm going to ask more questions. And I hadn't really thought about that, but it really happens there too.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, how many times are we in meetings where somebody will share an idea or say something and the immediate thought is, well, that won't work, or
right,
what a dumb idea, or
yeah,
obviously they're new here, kind of, instead of, is there any value in what they're saying? Is there any truth in what they're saying? Or if we probed or asked a few questions, maybe we'd come up with something better. See, and that comes down to just our inability to really listen to each other. Often we're reloading our argument before we've even heard what the other person has said.
I love the way you said that.
And so, and what's magical about that is actually when we just start to really listen in to others and ask those questions, what we discover in just a few minutes is very, very revealing and powerful often.
Yeah. And I find oftentimes if we don't do that, what we end up doing is solving the wrong challenge, like the one that we see on the surface. The wrong problem, the wrong opportunity even. And if we don't take that moment to back up and really think about it first, it takes us down the wrong – we might have a brilliant solution, but it's not actually solving the right challenge.
Yeah, I agree, because we do – like you said earlier, we want to jump to solutions. We want to also point out how things aren't going to work. We're just wired that way, right? There's no books on how to complain better at work, right?
No, because we nailed that.
We know how to do it, right? How to think more negatively about your workplace. It's how to have positive thinking and how to develop an attitude of gratitude and those types of things, because we're not naturally inclined to do that. We're good at the other stuff.
Yeah, we are naturally good at the other stuff. And I never really thought about that. You're right. There's no like how to say you don't like something at work.
Right.
We're pretty good at that. Right? That's funny.
Yeah. 101 ways to complain more. This just doesn't exist.
Oh God, that's hysterical. I wanted to ask you about something that you wrote that really spoke to me. And it's one of these things that, you hear, I guess it's a narrative in business that I think is inaccurate. And you really nailed it the way you talked about it. So you talk about our quote unquote people problems at work aren't actually people problems, that they're perspective problems. And we hear so much talk, like we got to deal with people. We have people issues. Tell us more about that. Because after I read the article that you wrote, I just was like, wow, that's a really powerful and I think actionable way to think about it.
Mm. Well, I this is really based on the work of the philosopher Martin Buber. And he talks about how we can see people in two ways. One way is that we see people kind of as objects, or another way to think about it is by their role, their function, the quintessential, just the number. And the other, and so when we're seeing people that way, we're kind of just seeing them in terms of, well, are you going to be useful to me, or are you against me, or do you even matter? And the other way is that we kind of see the fullness of a person. meaning they're really in all senses equal to me. And so what we often do in workplaces, and well, I'll say in any relationship, is we start to see people as objects. We just see them as this function. And the thing is that people know it, right? So when someone's just trying to use you or get something from you or even make a shallow compliment to you, we can tell. And the problem isn't them. It's how we're seeing them. It's our perspective on them. And so there's a way to see each other as just human beings, kind of wanting to do a good job, who have families and things that we care about at work, even when there's challenges. But we make the challenge a lot worse when we sort of start to see them just as the problem versus a person that might have a challenge or a person that's struggling or a person that's frustrated. And it's only fair to assume that people have those because I have them, right? There's days I'm frustrated at work, so it's only fair to assume that you would be. And I'm either now going to blame you for that and take it out on you and say, how dare she, or I'm going to try to help you. And often we're doing it the other way. So I think, blaming people is an easy one. But I think the first question we need to ask is how am I seeing them? It's really a self-awareness question to begin with.
Yeah, it really speaks to, I think in innovation in particular, we have this very they mentality. They don't get it. They're not visionaries. They're not seeing the brilliance. They, which mm-hmm. really, I think, speaks to what you're saying. But where are they coming from that they don't see why this is a good idea, or where I'm not getting buy-in for my ideas, or I'm not tapping them for their knowledge? It's not coming out. What do you do? So let's say you're a team, you recognize that. What do you do to get everybody to really own taking a step back and saying, hey, let me see what my lens is about before I judge that person?
Yeah. So part of this is about empathy, right? So first, if I'm seeing another group as the they, all I'm now looking for are all the ways that they aren't meeting my expectations,
right,
or they're failing.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm going to find them, right? It's like when you buy a new car and you're driving down the highway and all of a sudden you notice how many of those cars are on the highway, right? It's not that there's more cars on the highway. It's just now you're seeing them that way, right? You're noticing them. So if I want to notice how another team is failing me, I'll find all of the evidence to support that. And so it starts with trying to get into their world. It's what must their world be like? What are the challenges that they're facing? What are the challenges they're facing actually that we have laid on them? One of the questions I like to ask managers or leaders is, we're really good at measuring how other people are impacting us, but what's it like for your employees to work for you?
Right? I'm only laughing because I think we never ask that question and we never take ownership of the fact that, hey, Jeff, when I go and I ask you to do something or I need something from you or I've got a deadline that I'm now imposing on you, what that does to you.
Right. We don't
never
ask
think
that
about
question.
That. Yeah.
So what's it like for my assistant to work for me when everything I ask for is last minute? What's it like for my team when I'm constantly under pressure and become very sort of short tempered or dictatorial or whatever? So it's an impact question, right? Again, I just like to reverse it and say, what's it like for them to work for me? I'll often say, look, if we had video cameras around the office and we could watch the management movie of you, right, what would we see? And you know what? It kind of ends up being a bit of a comedy is what ends up happening.
Honestly, there's times where I might be a little bit horrified about what it's like to work for me.
Well, that's right. Because remember, back to the very beginning of this conversation, is if I asked you what type of manager you are, under pressure, there's your sort of habits you've created, but then there's that story you create, right? So I never have a manager say, well, Jeff, I'm the type of manager that's only fair with some people, or my door's half open, right? Right. It's always, no, I'm solution focused. I'm a people person. You can always that's the story that we tell ourselves and then believe it. So it's really trying to help people unpack and get at who we are and how we're impacting others. And so when we can start to see what the challenges are of other teams or other individuals on our team, departments, whatever it is, then we're now in a place where we can actually offer real solutions and real help, or even change the ways that we are working in order to make their work easier.
Hello, Launch Street. I am here once again with Derek, who is the president of Brility, and he's going to throw some wisdom bombs on us. So, Derek, here's my question. As the president of Brility, you interact with clients across a whole range of industries. What have you seen across the industries are the biggest challenges facing business growth today?
Hi, Tamara. That's a great question. The biggest challenge, without a doubt, is a concept we refer to as liquid turf. The dynamic environment of business right now moves at an exceptional pace. We have technology that's changing. We have business forces that are changing. We have regulation, international competition. The rate and pace of change is dizzying. And then add to that a lack of time and money and resources. It's quite challenging right now.
So here's my question about that, though. I mean, wouldn't a smart strategy help you manage change?
That's exactly correct. What we find, however, is people don't really understand strategy. They have goals and aspirations, and they have a detailed to-do list and a plan. A strategy is something really between those two. I mean, it's interlocking concepts that have compounding effects that are based on research. And most importantly, Tamara, the strategy is a living, breathing thing. It needs to be dynamic and adaptive to the future. And that's where we come in with our digital approach. We build systems that adapt the strategy as the market changes, as we learn more, as your business objectives may expand or contract. That really is the key.
So how does your company help solve those challenges for your clients?
That's another great question. We will sit down. We go over the objectives of the client as well as their current thinking and momentum. And then we do what's called a digital presence assessment, where we map out all of the different technologies and market forces that could inform our strategy on how to achieve those objectives. And we present the client with the options. And from there, we can collaborate and make informed plans and decisions, as well as a coherent action plan.
So, Derek, this might be a naive question, but why is a digital platform so important to strategy and growth today?
Oh, that's a great question. It is the immediacy and the granularity of the feedback. We are able to learn so rapidly and adapt so rapidly if everything is set up correctly that the best way to keep up with the pace of the marketplace is both to grab opportunities as well as to handle challenges is through the digital platforms.
All right, Launch Street, I'm going to go, first of all, make sure that I have a dynamic strategy and not a set in stone goal. And I would hope that you would all do the same now that Derek has helped me understand the difference. Derek, thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you.
Well, and what I appreciate about what you're saying too is, you know, as someone who has, you know, run teams and companies, I used to get really frustrated when my team would bring me these really kind of lackluster incremental solutions to whatever it was or approaches to things that we were going after and doing. And I would get so frustrated. And really looking back, what I needed to be asking that I didn't at that time was, what am I doing to not create the space for them? And if I were really being, you know, boldly honest, I would say that I was putting so much pressure on them for so many things that they probably didn't have the space. So, and my perspective of them at that time was very, they're not doing good enough, basically. You know, they're not innovative enough. But really, it was, my perspective was wrong.
Yeah, and so when I'm seeing people that way, right, mm-hmm. they know it.
Yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, really.
Right, and they can feel it. You don't have to say it for them to know that they're failing you in some way. And when I'm in that place, now it's like, now I'm kind of almost tiptoeing, right? I'm not sure what to do. So I'm definitely not in a place of creativity or possibility or new solutions. I just want to do the right thing and kind of survive this, right? So that's to your point, that's where our teams can kind of end up, and we don't see our impact on it. It's no different than the leader who always has the answers. And then they complain that their team never comes up with answers. It's because they've learned that it doesn't matter what they say, the leader's going to, you know, override it.
Well, and this is going to sound like a tangent, but I swear it relates back. I think in trying to focus on the bringing the right solution, you really pigeonhole yourself into a total lack of creativity and innovation. And often, most often than not, that you end up getting it wrong because you're so worried, will that person think it's right? And this is many years ago now, but when I first got to UC Berkeley for college, I didn't believe I belonged there. I couldn't even believe I got in. So I was like, I was imposter syndrome all the way. But I'll never forget, I had this anthropology class, and it was the TA program, you know, the little study groups that the grad students run. And we had to come in with a perspective on this one paper and or this one narrative. And I'll never forget, I was so worried about getting it right versus that I couldn't really read what was in front of me. And I got it so wrong. And looking back, it was so obvious. The answer was obvious. It really was. But I was so worried about right that I couldn't even consume the information to get to the place that actually was right. If that, you know what I mean? Like, it was just so all consuming.
Yeah. I think real biggest challenges for some leaders, and it's a real hard one, is the need to be right. Because automatically others have to be wrong. So, you know, I'm not in a place, oh, that's interesting, and I'll hone my opinion or adjust. I'm just in a place of defending what I think is the right way. And so we are very sophisticated at work at talking about, you know, well, in my experience, or given right. the research I've read, like you know, we're good at it, but it's really about me being right and you being wrong. And the other piece to this is, that I think is really important, is that there's this idea at times that to be creative and innovative means that we have to have, you know, 3-day retreats.
Yeah, right. Totally.
You know, meditating all day. And then this really, that it's this only this thing that happens in this magical space of time. When I really believe that if we really are seeing each other, you know, in the fullness of humanity, as people working together, that I don't get into this sort of objectification of others, that creativity can happen very often, because the space is there where you know that there's that freedom, right? That I genuinely care about you and your success. And so now all the posturing and the defensiveness and am I going to get it right stuff is gone.
Yeah. You know, I think I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. And I'm a firm believer that, you know, true innovation, creativity, whatever word we want, we kind of use more innovation, thinking differently about what's right in front of you. But whatever language speaks to you, the best moments don't happen in the 3 p.m. brainstorm. It's really forced in those moments. It really happens in the work that's right in front of you if you have the room and the tools to do it. And there's so much opportunity to innovate and work smarter with what's right in front of you. You don't really have to go, to your point, to the 3-day retreat with the funky brainstorming. I mean, I love them. Don't get me wrong. They're great
sure.
for other reasons. But you know, it should happen in your day-to-day work.
It happens when we feel, this will sound maybe a little funny, it happens when we feel really safe at
yeah.
work, in
yeah.
our space and who we are and our position, you know, and that the relationships are trustworthy. And when that's there, then there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes away. You know, the office politicky kind of stuff, right? It just doesn't exist. And so now I can walk into my manager's office and I can share ideas, and some are going to land and some aren't, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not worried about it.
And that's okay. And I think, just to loop it back to what you said earlier, a couple things. Our job as leaders is to, one, truly listen, to not load our response as they're talking. And two, to be a little more curious about why, regardless of if the idea is going to work or not work, why and how they came up with the idea. So that we mm-hmm. can understand, and maybe I think oftentimes when we do that, there's some value in the why and the how that we can actually take forward, even if the idea itself doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I want to bring it back to you for a minute. When you think about how you innovate, and I'm sure it's in a lot of the things we talked about of having a safe space and all this, but you personally, how do you do it? How do you apply and create that innovation?
Mm. So for me, a few things. One is I have to kind of, in the sense, center myself, or just kind of go inward, not be worried about all the external things, I guess. So, you know, I have to actually kind of ground myself a little bit. I have to really focus on this attitude of curiosity, right? So it's sort of like when you're researching something, say, on the internet, and it's, you know, you just, oh, that's neat. And then it takes you to another link and another link. So you need that curious kind of space. And a big one for me is to suspend judgment. You know, there's always this voice that says, yeah, that won't work, or my idea is not good enough, or other people maybe are doing this. And, you know, it's really to suspend or quiet or just close that voice down that wants to judge. And so those go hand in hand with the curiosity space. And for me, it's writing, it's, you know, it's thinking, it's pacing, it's, you know, flip chart. I have a flip chart in my office where I just, you know, flip chart stuff, and it's just to kind of get it out there.
I appreciate what you're saying about going inward. I think oftentimes when we think about being innovative or, like, you know, people who think that way, we think of the extroverts, people like me who are like, blah, all the time, you know, and really there's all of us can innovate. And those of us who go inward or are more introverts or just need are more processors than verbal processors deserve the space to do it too. And I think we often, I'd love to hear your perspective on this. I think we often set up space for the extrovert and for the talker, and we don't set up space for the one who needs maybe that reflection, individual time, like different ways to actually come to their thinking and their ideas.
Yeah. So part of seeing people as people at work is to respect, understand, and recognize that we don't all process the same way. So, right. And we tend to think, well, the way I do it is the way that others ought to do it, or the way that others do it. And so we might be extroverted and want to chat about this with three or four people, but you also know there's that woman or that man that, you know, they go away and 3 days later they come back and they've got a very well formulated idea and plan. Yeah. And you're like, where did that come from? And,
right.
And that's their process. So part of innovation, I think, is learn what works for you and trust it.
I especially the trust, like that's something I think we should just take a pause and talk about, because much like my college story, I don't think we trust our instincts enough or trust our own way of doing it. We're trying to, and I think as leaders, we kind of make the mistake of like, this is how I do it. So we just assume that's how it's done. And that's hard, right? We're putting a square peg in a round hole or a round peg, whatever that phrase is.
Yeah. Right.
Versus to your point, recognizing other people do it differently. And then us as individuals trusting that, hey, yeah, I get it. I'm not going to have the answer in 5 minutes, but this is how my brain works, and what I will come back with will be fantastic.
Right. So I'm really hesitant with. There's lots of leadership material and books, and you know people teaching some great stuff, and some of those tools are really great. But I caution leaders to not emulate, but to integrate. You know, so the way that you do it, if I just try to copy that, like behaviorally, it's probably not going to work. Now, there might be some things I can pull from it, but I need to integrate that into me, into how I do things. And, you know, we usually don't have to go external to figure that out. We just have to trust what we've already done and we've always been doing. So if your process to figure out a problem is to go talk to 15 friends and you read a book that says, well, what you really should be doing is, you know, silent meditation for 2 days, that's not going to work for you. You got to trust your own process, respect it. And, you know, you can adjust and hone it with external material and tools, but you are you. And that's part of, you know, bringing your humanity to work is show up as you are. And as you learn is to integrate that with who you are, not just try to copy what other people are doing, because there's no authenticity to that.
You know, I think in innovation, this is a big challenge, because we think innovation has to be these big, bold, creative, you know, magical moments. And that doesn't work for all of us. And it's why we actually – so we built an assessment called the IQAC, Innovation Quotient Edge. But what really resonates with what you're talking about is there's 9 styles of innovation, and you've got 2 of those are your power styles, basically. So,
right.
You know, and what you were just describing is a collaborative. It's a person who pulls disparate people and ideas and experiences together to create innovation. And that's a different style than someone who's an inquisitive who innovates by asking questions versus someone who is a risk taker, which is me, which is all about leaping and being uncomfortable. And actually that pressure for us is how we innovate. It's our best way. We tend to kind of leap and figure it out, not haphazardly, but in that space is where we actually do our best work. And recognizing that different people innovate differently allows all of us to your point, to bring our humanity to work.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
So let me ask you before we kind of close out about the name Magnanimous.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's the company name. So tell me more. Because that's not normal. in a good way, actually, the way that sounded was horrible. But you know
I love it. It's a name that's always a word that I've always loved. My brand, people don't, you know, they say, well, it's hard to say, spell, and whatever. So from the Latin, magna means big or great, if you think of a magnum of wine, right? So magna means big or great. Animus is one of these words that to me has multiple meanings, but essentially mind, soul, mind, spirit. So really it's about, you know, the way I think of it is competence or being really good at what you do and also having, you know, sort of, you know, a spirit of care about others and how you do it. So magnanimous is really about integrating or pulling together great minds and great souls. It's not just the business science, and it's not just about having a great culture or being people focused. It's that we can be both. I can care about the people I work with, genuinely want them to be successful, and expect, you know, high performance and develop that, and expect my company and work for my company to be a profitable, productive place as well. And we've separated so much and even created a hierarchy that, you know, profitability and productivity, that's sort of real business. And then this culture people stuff is sort of this other stuff that we have to deal with when, you know, it's the, you might say that it's the profit that, that fuels your business, but it's the people that drive it. Right. So we need to integrate these things. And that's really what I'm really advocating and trying to help people do. And I think that the business science side, we've got pretty well figured out. That's not where our challenges are. Our challenges are is in how we really genuinely are caring about working with each other. And I intentionally use that word care because when we feel cared for by those that we work with, our productivity and performance goes up exponentially. And that's sort of well proven. And we know it from our own life experience.
You know, it's so funny to me because I think, Jeff, somewhere along the way, we bought into this rule that you leave your emotions and your personal life at the door when you enter work. And I'm not saying it should be a free for all of, you know, let's talk about our weekends all day. But I think that's actually hindered our ability to do business, given everything you're saying.
Well, I would just ask, you know, if you've played sports or even had a piano teacher or whatever, as I have, you know, when you have a coach that you know genuinely wants you to be successful, you tend to play harder for them, right? You don't want to let them down. You know, everything elevates. And, you know, we can also have coaches that are technically very good. They know the game inside and out. They know all the drills, all that. And really they're more about themselves than really our development. We don't tend to play as well for them.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. And work is the same way.
Work is exactly the same way. So the thing that makes us uniquely human from AI or robots or anything else is our ability to connect. And we're relational people, right? We need to connect at a deeper level. And you're quite right that people are afraid when you say, well, we need to genuinely care about each other's success and each other at work. They immediately jump to, oh, I guess I have to go camping every weekend with these people. You know, it's like this huge leap, right? And it's just not the case, right?
And totally. And I think that the, you know, foosball table and the, you know, drinks on Thursday don't do anything to support that at all, actually.
They don't if they're not done with the intention of really caring. So I can fake caring, right? Like I can, if I do all the things that show I care about you, but I really don't, you know it, right? You just go, well, this guy's fake. So what it comes down to is not so much our behaviors and actions. What's more important is whether I do genuinely care about your success. And when I genuinely care about your success as an employee or a coworker or client, you can tell. And that's what builds trust. That's what builds engagement, loyalty, and ultimately more successful companies.
And I just want to loop it back to the thing about perspective too, with what you're saying. I would venture to say that most people want to care at work, but it's been kind of beat out of them a little bit. So if I have that boss who I say, well, that boss doesn't care about me, to your point about perspective earlier, like I should probably ask, why is that person so lacking in caring? Or why do I feel that? Where are they coming from that seems to be the case? Mm-hmm. I think we often, you know, I'm sure you've seen all the stats of, you know, people leave not because of the job, because of their boss, right? It's like, mm-hmm. It's always the case. And I believe it. But I would like to assume the best in people, that most of us want to care and want to bring that to work. And it's either it's been beat out of us, we're exhausted, it's not the role model we had. I mean, would you say that's true?
Yeah, and I think that people are scared. You know, we teach Excel, we teach ROI, we teach metrics, all good stuff, right? We teach strategy. We don't teach character. We don't teach people to be human. Some managers might even want or desire to have honest or difficult conversations with people or what have you, but they don't know where the lines are. They don't know how to have them, and so they avoid them. And we've definitely created a workplace culture. I mean, this is very generally speaking, but it's in our language, right? It's not personal, right? How is something not personal? And even the worst of this is this mindset of just metrics, ROI, goal-driven, whatever, productivity, efficiency. The reverse happens where we're spending 8, 9, 10 hours a day in that space, and then we go home and we start to apply to our families,
right,
and our relationships,
totally.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the other thing you said right in the very beginning of the conversation or alluded to was there's a myth that people think it takes a lot of time to care. And it doesn't. If we just care, very quickly that trust will build, that engagement is there. And so while it might seem like it takes more time to build relationships and I don't have time to do that, we're not talking about, 3-hour conversations every day, right? There's just small ways that I demonstrate care. How do I help you be successful? That's the question I need to be asking. And so one of the questions too, if my boss doesn't care about me, the question I'd ask is, well, do I care about him or her?
Right. Or am I making them the bad guy?
Right. And do I care about my employees or my coworkers?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I'm so glad we're having this conversation because I think that, I'm all about human innovation. So how do we bring more innovation to what we do? It makes us happy as humans to do that. Like, it taps our reward center. It is how we get ahead in this crazy world. And I think it's how we can actually collaborate and build together. But I don't think any of that happens without a very fundamental levels of trust and vulnerability and safeness, as we were talking about. Without that, none of the other stuff exists.
Absolutely. So there's the magic, right? The great irony to me is the way that we build successful, trustworthy, engaged organizations is by bringing to the workplace that which makes us unique, which is our humanity, our ability to be empathic, compassionate, and caring, which doesn't mean, let's be clear, doesn't mean I allow people now just to do everything. Like, this isn't, kumbaya and rainbows. It's if I actually genuinely care about you and you're not being successful, I care enough to sit down and have that conversation with you, right?
Well, to go to your coach's point, my kids' coaches, I have two boys that are 14 and 10 on various teams. They are tough as nails on my kids, but my kids love it, not because they love to be told they're doing something wrong or whatever, but because they actually truly recognize that those coaches genuinely care about their performance and them as human beings. And they want both to be successful. They want them to, get great leadership and human skills, and they want them to succeed in their, competitions. And that combination, I think, allows you to have tough conversations.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. And if they're just really good coaches technically, but they don't generally care about the kids, giving their best, being their best, offering all that they can, all those things, wanting them to genuinely be successful on the field or wherever they're playing, the kids know it, and they're going to whine about the coach, right? They're not going to want to play for him. And it's no different in the rest of our relationships, whether they're at home or they're at work.
I have to tell you, because it just happened. I was just at so my oldest is about to go to high school. So we went to listen to the head coach talk about his philosophy and all that for sports, because we wanted to hear, okay, what's the program here? And the coach got up there and he's talking and he goes, "Here's the deal, parents." He said, "I'm not going to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you." And at first I was like, oh, like, what? Like, you don't want to talk to me? I'll email you all the time. Are you kidding me? Like, why? And then he said, "Here's the thing. If your kid is going to be late to practice, late to a game, can't make a game, is out of town, it's on them to tell me. And it's on them to tell me because I want them to become great men, great leaders." And I was so blown away by his perspective, but it really falls into what you're saying with – like, he has these incredible boundaries and toughness to him, and that took me by surprise. But when he explained that, I thought, oh, wow, he really cares about the development of these kiddos. It's not just the sport for him. And I don't think I would have gotten there had I not heard him say that,
Right, right. Yeah, that's a great story to, you know, sort of illustrate that, that there's something he's about which is more than just, you know, the technicalities of
yes,
the game or winning the cup,
too, right?
So to speak.
It's not just you're good at your job technically and can do what's on the job description, but also all the other stuff too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So,
it's a great story.
First of all, where can people go to learn and connect more with you?
So, website is magnanimous.ca. I'm on LinkedIn, so I'm easy to find there. Facebook, of course, and those would be the main ways you can get me, or email me if you want as well.
We'll put those links in the show notes. My last question for you is, I was actually really happy to ask you this question this way. I got all geeked out about it. What's your kind of last piece of advice for those of us that want to be more magnanimous? I just like to say the word. It's a great word.
Isn't it a great word?
Yeah, it is. It makes you happy.
You know what? I think it's, it's a great question. Develop an attitude of curiosity and ask yourself, what's it like for others to live, work, and be with me?
Mm. Great question.
Right? And when I can think about that, you know, hopefully I'm not from a defensive place, right? But from an honest space, it's an, and now what occurs for me to do, right? Yeah. What do I need to do differently now? Because magnanimity is about being excellent, I think, at what you do. And it's about doing it from a place of sort of caring and compassion.
Right. Well, Jeff, this has been fantastic. It was wonderful to kind of dig deep into the human side of work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And glad to chat with you.
Fascinating, right? You know what else is fascinating? You and how you innovate. How you innovate. Your style of innovation is your differentiator and your value in this cluttered world. I differentiate myself and I provide massive contribution by being an experiential risk taker. So what are you? How about you find out? Go to our website, gotolaunchstreet.com, G-O-T-O, launchstreet.com, all one word. Click on Take Assessment and let's see how you provide your greatest unique self to the world. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. G-O-T-O, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.